It is so good to be with you here today, and it's such a privilege to just be able to share some thoughts and words with you. And as I look out, I see so many familiar faces now, and that's just such a nice feeling to have. When Stina asked if I'd be interested in preaching, and I saw some of the possible passages that I could choose from, the parable of the Good Samaritan, it was a no-brainer for me. Back in seminary, I just developed a real passion and love and interest for parables, and I find them challenging. I find them provoking. They're not always nice to you. They can make you wrestle with yourself, a lot of self-reflection, but they're also a little bit of a puzzle. They don't always state the obvious. You really have to work on them, and then in turn, they can work on you. So the parable of the Good Samaritan was, like I said, it was a no-brainer. And as I was in seminary, I would deal with a lot of these parables, and I noticed quickly that I didn't always have the same type of reaction to the parables that people in the stories had to them. For instance, the disciples sometimes would hear these parables and they were dumbfounded or confused, and they would ask Jesus, you know, what do these parables mean? And he would explain to them. And then in another instance, some scribes and chief priests heard Jesus speak these parables, and they were immediately furious with him and they wanted to lay hands on him. And then in another instance, Pharisees heard Jesus tell these parables, and they disagreed with what he had to say. So when Jesus tells parables in the New Testament, they do something to people. They make you wrestle with something. They challenge you. And I admit, sometimes when I read parables, I don't always get that feeling. Sometimes I walk away feeling good about myself. I gain this moral lesson. And it wasn't until I was introduced to a Jewish New Testament professor named Dr. Amy Jill Levine, who I believe some of you have read in your adult education classes or small groups, and she was able to help me see that parables aren't always rosy and cozy and nice moral lessons and something that we just tell our children. They can really speak to us. And so what I'd like for us to do today is I want us to read the parable of the Good Samaritan, not from our 21st century modern Western Christian perspective. I want us to read it from a first century Jewish perspective, the perspective that would have originally heard the story being told. Now, as you heard the story wonderfully read today, the story begins with a lawyer who stood up to test Jesus. And what we know about lawyers in the New Testament, they're not often portrayed as the good guys. And here, it's the same case. We're told that first he calls Jesus a teacher. That's not top of the list of what the disciples and those around are calling Jesus, right? He's not a lot of respect given out. But we're also told that he wants to test Jesus. And in Greek, this is the same word that's used for when Satan goes to test Jesus in the wilderness. And then we're also told that he wants to ask Jesus a question that we find out he already knows the answer to. So up front, the lawyer is not up or is portrayed as a good guy, right? So he asks the question, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus replies with a provoking question, well, what's written in the law? What do you read there? And the lawyer replies, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, in your neighbor as yourself. And of course, Jesus then says, you've given the right answer, do this and you will live. When I read this, for me, if I were having this conversation with Jesus, this would have been a conversation ender. I would have been, thanks Jesus, now I will be on my way and live a life of loving God and loving neighbor. But of course, this lawyer doesn't stop there. It seems that he wants more. His question didn't get answered. Now we're told the lawyer wants to justify himself to Jesus. So he asks Jesus another question. And who is my neighbor? But this always comes off a little snarky, I think. At least for me. But technically it's not a snarky question. It's a good question. It's a legal question. Neighbors have the same rights and responsibilities that we do. Those up north of us in Canada, They do not have the same responsibilities and duties that we have. They can't vote in our election. We can't vote in their election. They're not one of us. So this question is not an uncommon question. We hear this all the time. If you turn on the news, any news, you're going to hear this packaged in some type of way. Who is our neighbor? So this is what the lawyer's looking at. Who is my neighbor? And we've heard this talked about so many times. We've heard this story so many times. And we know what he's getting at, right? Where is that line? Who's on my team? Who's not? Who's in my circle? Who's not? Who's on my side of the fence? Who's not? And ultimately, who am I to love and who am I not? So while this question, it might be a good legal question, Jesus doesn't seem concerned about the legalities of it. Jesus is concerned about love. And in the context of love, the answer is no one. Everyone deserves love, the Minnesotan and the Canadian. Everyone. Now, it's at this point in the story where Jesus begins to share the parable. And we should take note that it's not the first question that sparks Jesus to tell the parable. It's the second question. Who is my neighbor? As Jesus begins answering the question and he begins telling the parable, he says, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell into the hands of robbers, who stripped him, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead." Now, just to be clear, this was not Robin Hood and Little John and the Merry Men. These were violent thieves. These were gang members who didn't need a reason to leave you half dead. There was no motivation here. They beat the man, and he did nothing to deserve it. And then Jesus tells us that a priest, a Levite, and a Samaritan all come across this man. The priest sees the beaten man, but does nothing and goes around him. The Levite does the same thing. He sees the beaten man, does nothing, and goes around him. Then the Samaritan sees the beaten man, but is moved with compassion and pity. So he provides him health care, puts him up in a good Airbnb, finds a caretaker, and writes a blank check and says he'll come back for the rest. Now, throughout the years, commentators have tried to get the priest and Levite out of jail, so to speak. There was impurity rules that are in place. They couldn't help this person in need. There were consequences that we just don't know about. And I get that. I see a broken down vehicle on the side of the highway, and I start having a running list of reasons why I shouldn't stop. They have AAA tow trucks on the way. Everybody today has a cell phone. The police will be there. I got to be somewhere. I don't have time. This is a dangerous place to pull over. They're a stranger. There might be robbers on the road. But at the end of the day, the priest and Levi do not have a reason for not helping the beaten man. And Jesus doesn't give them an excuse either. I've always found Martin Luther King Jr.'s words here interesting and helpful. He said the priest and Levi, they don't have an excuse for not helping. And they approach this man asking the question, "If I stop and help, what will happen to me?" But the Samaritan asked the question, "If I don't stop, what will happen to him?" Whatever the case may be, the priest and Levite, they had a responsibility to help save a man's life, and they didn't. But the Samaritan did. I think most of us would agree that the moral of this story, or the big takeaway, is don't be like the priest, don't be like the Levite, be like the Samaritan. Have pity, show compassion, give love. After all, this is the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's not the parable of the priest and Levite. Hospitals and organizations aren't named after the priest and Levite. They're named after the Good Samaritan. Laws are not named after the priest and Levite. They're named after the Good Samaritan. You see, it's the perspective of the Good Samaritan that we often identify and associate ourselves with. It's because when we hear a story, we naturally tend to read ourselves into that story. We're Cinderella, not the ugly stepsisters. We're Luke Skywalker, not Darth Vader. We're the humans, not the aliens from outer space. In fact, former U.S. President George W. Bush said in his first inaugural address, "I can pledge our nation to a goal. When we see that wounded traveler on the road to Jericho, we will not pass on the other side." Historically, we've identified ourselves as the Samaritan, and that's a good thing. We should all strive to be like the Good Samaritan. We should all strive to show Christ-like love and compassion to those who are lying in a ditch. However, this is only one side of the story. This is only one perspective. And this is not a perspective from a first century Jew. So this brings us to beg the question, how would a first century Jew have heard this story? How would they have understood it? For us, a priest, a Levite, and a Samaritan, they're a package deal. They all come together in the story. It's natural. But for a first century Jew, this would not have been the case. Because Jews understood that there is a division of three groups. There's priests who descended from Aaron. There's Levites who descended from Levi, one of the 12 tribes of Israel, one of Jacob's kids, and the rest were Israelites. In Judaism, this is known as the rule of three. So I'm going to try something here. If I were to say Father and Son, you would say? Okay. If I were to say Larry, Mo, you would say? All right, for my younger generation, if I say Ron, Harry, you say? Hermione. Okay, got it. Great. So in the same way that you all just finished my sentences, when a first century Jew would have heard Jesus say, a priest and a Levite, they would have said, and an Israelite. But that's not what we get here. We get a Samaritan. According to one Jewish interpreter, they said going from a priest to a Levite to a Samaritan would have been like going from a father to son to Satan. It's unthinkable. It just doesn't fit. Now, it's unthinkable because of Samaritans, and the Jewish relationship was complicated. They were natural enemies. So when we look at this from the perspective of a first century Jew, we shouldn't think of Samaritans as outcasts or oppressed, but rather outcasters and oppressors. They're a hated enemy. In fact, in Luke chapter 9, just one chapter before this story, we're told that the disciples and Jesus tried to go into a Samaritan village and they weren't welcomed. Now I'm going to read to you this passage real quick. It says, when the days drew near for him, Jesus, to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. He sent his messengers ahead of him. On their way, they entered a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. But they did not receive him because his face was set towards Jerusalem. When his disciples, James and John, saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them. Then they went on to another village. I love James and John's response. But you can hear this built-up tension. The hatred goes both ways here. So for a first century Jew, who do they identify with in this story? They're not a priest. They're not a Levite. They're certainly not a Samaritan. It's the beaten man in the ditch. Now, for those who don't know me very well, one of my hobbies, and my wife might call it more than a hobby, but I love to fish. I love to get out on the water and fish for all different types of fish, but the way that I like to do it is in my kayak. And a few summers ago, my wife and I were fishing a small river in North Carolina in the summer, and we were out there having a good time, and it was summer, so the water levels were a little down, and there were a lot of these exposed rocks. And as we were floating down, I approached a set of rapids, and they weren't extreme rapids. They weren't too dangerous, but the rocks made them a little bit more difficult to maneuver. And as I approached the rapids, the current took me into a rock. And I ended up getting pinned up against these rocks. And of course, the current comes up against my kayak, and my kayak begins to tip. And as I tip, my natural reaction was to jump out. I have a life vest on and everything, but I jump out, and as I jump out, I hit the bottom, and I'm standing here in this current up to my waist. And as I get out of the kayak, my weight shifts, so the kayak begins to take off downriver. So I reach and try to grab the kayak and hold on to it, and I'm in this predicament where the current's trying to push me, so I'm trying to resist the current. I'm trying to hold on to my kayak with all my expensive fishing gear, and if I let go, the kayak's downriver. So, of course, adrenaline, emotion, all these thoughts are going through my head. How am I going to get out of this situation? And quickly, if you've ever been in the river, current can zap your energy pretty quick, so it makes you speed up the process of trying to figure out how to get out of this situation. And I look over to the shore. I'm not far from shore, and I see a family over there. And I'm thinking to myself, I need help right now. I need help to get out of this situation. I don't think I can do it on my own. And I look over at this family, and I'll never forget this feeling. I look at them, and I'm looking for them to help me. And I look into their eyes, and there's nothing there. And I quickly realize that they're not jumping in the water to help me. That this is all on me. I'm going to have to figure out how to get this situation under control. I wonder if that's what the beaten man felt, a little bit of that, when he saw the priest and Levite, those who he expected to help save his life, the people he called neighbors, but they didn't. They passed by. What I find fascinating about this parable is what comes next. It's not the person we expect to help us. Rather, it's the person who we thought might kill us. Mm-hmm. That's the person who saves us. It's the enemy, not our neighbor, who comes to rescue us. I think this parable is not just an answer to the question, who is my neighbor? It's so much more than that. I invite you today, put yourself in this position. Put yourself in the position of a beaten man, lying in a ditch, needing help. What would you do? What would you think? How would you feel if your enemy was approaching you? What is this parable saying to you today? Perhaps this parable challenges us to look at ourselves and discover, will we be able to allow our enemy to help us? Most of us are great at loving, but can we receive love, especially from our enemy? Maybe this parable challenges us to knock down the walls of preconceived notions and stereotypes that we hold on to. Maybe it's about pride. Are we okay letting someone else help us, our enemy, be right, be helpful, be in charge, be good? Maybe this story challenges us to ask the question, do we truly want our enemies to be nice? Do we want to destroy the walls that we've built up and change our relationship with our enemies? Because when our enemies help us, they take pity on us, they love us, they show us compassion, that just screws up our relationship with them. We no longer see them as a category, mm-hmm. Our enemy. They're human now. They're a helper. They're someone like us, someone made in the image of God. Perhaps it's about giving our enemy a chance to love. Because if we don't, we might end up dead in the ditch. Maybe the story's about vulnerability. I'm not gonna sit up here and pretend that giving my enemy a chance is not dangerous or foolish. And I think most of us would admit and agree that that's kind of what makes this unsettling and challenging. They might take advantage of the opportunity. But if we never give our enemy a chance, who will? Maybe that one chance is all they need. What does this parable say to you today? When Jesus asked the lawyer, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? The lawyer was unable to say the name Samaritan. All he could say was the one who showed pity. He could only bring himself to name the action and not the person. Can we finally agree that it is better to acknowledge the humanity of our enemy in the potential of our enemy to do good rather than lie in a ditch dead? Or will we be like the lawyer, the one who couldn't admit that his enemy has the potential to love? Amen.